Welcome to Two-Way Street. It's a sad fact that terrorist attacks dominated the headlines throughout much of 2015. As this new year gets underway, the world is on higher alert than ever before for the possibility of new acts of terrorism. But behind the chilling headlines, every terrorist attack is really the story of individual people, the victims, their families and friends, and yes, the perpetrators of these atrocities too. That's what Mike Kelly wanted to explore when he set out to write his new book, The Bus on Jaffa Road. In it, he tells the story of a suicide bombing that took place on the number 18 bus in Jerusalem on February 25, 1996. Two young Americans, Sarah Duker and Matthew Eisenfeld, and almost two dozen others died that day. By delving deeply into the lives of Duker and Eisenfeld, Kelly accomplishes his goal of adding human depth to the terrible tragedy of a merciless attack. But he goes even further by interviewing the bomb maker himself, and thus giving us a window into the souls of those who to this day wage jihad against the West. Kelly is a reporter for New Jersey's Bergen Record. He covered the immediate aftermath of 9/11 and has been reporting on terrorism around the world ever since. We recorded our conversation in front of a live audience at the Atlanta Jewish Book Festival. It took place just a few days after the terrorist assaults in Paris, but the subsequent attack in San Bernardino makes our conversation even more pertinent today. Mike Kelly, what a pleasure to talk with you. I really enjoyed reading your book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Would you mind...
It's a pleasure being here with you.
Well, thanks. Okay, so let's, if we can, I think the elephant in the room today, and it's certainly kind of in a chilling way apropos of what we're going to talk about
sure.
with the bus on Jaffa Road. Well, let's talk a bit about Paris. You wrote a column that I read this morning
sure.
at what, filed yesterday?
Yep.
And I just briefly quote from it. This is for the Bergen Record, where you've worked for 40 years.
40 years.
Very briefly, one paragraph. For U.S. counterterrorism officials, the carnage at so many soft targets in the French capital underscores one of the most vexing dilemmas. It's one thing to protect government buildings, but something else entirely to protect thousands of cafes, bars, and theaters. And then you quote a colonel with the New Jersey State Police, Colonel Rick Fuentes. In an open society, these things are always a challenge.
Correct, sure.
So I thought about that because clearly that's exactly what happened on the number 18 bus on Jaffa Road back in 1996. But talk for a minute about your thoughts. Did you flash back when you heard the news from Paris?
Oh, of course. I really started covering terrorism on the morning of 9/11. I literally left the newsroom of my newspaper, drove to the Hudson River, and jumped on a tugboat and crossed the Hudson River and walked into Ground Zero about an hour after the towers fell. And I kept chipping away at the story. And which eventually led me to this book. But whenever something like this happens, and particularly Paris, it just brings me back in a way that is deeply poignant, I think, because what we saw in Paris was the same thing we saw on the number 18 bus on a Sunday morning in downtown Jerusalem, and that was innocent people trying to go about their ordinary lives. That bus was filled with people, some trying to go to work. In the case of the two protagonists in my book, Matthew and Sarah, they were two lovers trying to get away for the weekend. But there were other people on that bus going out to look for apartments, going to work, et cetera. And yet they all died going about their ordinary lives. And that, I think, is what is the most difficult aspect of life to protect when you're talking about counterterrorism. And that was what I was trying to get to in the column I wrote about Paris.
Well, and in fact, another parallel between your column of this weekend and the book, early in the book, you say that when you did get on that ferry and go across to the World Trade Center site, one of the things that you started dealing with in your mind, thinking over was, the impact
sure.
on ordinary people. Why did their loved ones have to die? And that question propelled a good portion of the research you did on this book.
Sure. You know, so much in journalism, here's how terrorism is covered. A bomb or an attack takes place somewhere in the world. And then, and we saw a little bit of this with the Paris attacks, although I think not as much, thankfully. But what happens is a bomb or an attack takes place somewhere in the world. Then in the next paragraph, we describe how many people were killed or wounded. Then we say what group claims responsibility. And then maybe we get into the diplomatic and political implications of this particular act. And we forget about something very central. And that is, for the people who lost loved ones, for those families, their lives change forever. And what I know, and what came to me out of 9/11, and maybe many of you as well, there was such, it was very personal, particularly in the New York area. So many people knew people who died. And that propelled me really to explore what I think was really the untold story of terrorism, and that is, what do ordinary people do about it, and how does it impact their lives?
So you're thinking about all this after 9/11.
Sure.
You used to visit the Teaneck, New Jersey library frequently.
Sure.
And in your walk back from the library, you would pass routinely a statue near a municipal building. What was the statue and what was it called?
Well, it's called An Unfinished Life. Sarah Duker had been killed on the number 18 bus. She was a resident of Teaneck, New Jersey, the town I live in. I had written about it when it happened, and like so many people in my profession, I moved on. And that was 1996. After 9/11, and I'm covering terrorism, and my newspaper is sending me literally all over the world, back and forth to the Middle East. And when I say Middle East, I'm talking Israel, Gaza, West Bank. I was in Southeast Asia following this story. I was in and out of Guantanamo Bay. I was even in Iraq. And I think over time, it was starting to wear me down. I was feeling frustrated about it. As I said, I wasn't getting deep enough into the story. I was writing a lot about terrorism, but I wasn't getting to the depth, and that was how it impacts ordinary people. So one day I'm taking a walk through town, and as I often did, just to kind of really to blow off steam, and I pass this statue again, and I knew it was there, and it's a beautiful statue. It's a statue of a young woman leaning over a rose bush to smell it, and it's a statue to Sarah, and all it says is an unfinished life. And I said, I want to tell the story of that unfinished life.
Tell us more about Sarah.
Well, Sarah was Martin Indyk, let me put it this way, Martin Indyk, who was our ambassador to Israel at the time of these killings, when he spoke at the airport when their bodies were taken home, and he said, these were America's best. Sarah was a graduate of Barnard College, which is the women's college for Columbia University. She wanted to be a research scientist, particularly an environmental scientist. At the time of her death, she was working at Hebrew University in water research, clean water research. She was also struggling with something I found very, very interesting. Like so many of us, I think, we struggle, where do we fit in with our faith? Where does she as a modern woman fit into her Jewish tradition, so to speak? So this is the kind of woman she was at the time. Young woman, early 20s, wrestling with a professional career, also wrestling with what kind of faith tradition, where she could fit into that faith tradition.
And her boyfriend, Matthew Eisenfeld.
Sure.
By the way, I must tell you that I'm not sure if I interpreted this correctly or not. You can tell me. There was talk that they might be getting married. You
yes.
were never able to quite pin down whether they were actually engaged. My sense in the way that you describe it is that he was madly in love, head over heels in love
he
with
was.
Her.
He
and
was.
Would have married her in a heartbeat. She was still trying to figure out her life a little bit. Is that
yes.
kind of what you came to?
Yes,
that?
Yes.
Okay, but go ahead.
Actually, it's very meaningful that Rabbi Michael Bernstein is here today because Michael has a small walk-on part in the book. Michael was a friend of Sarah and Matthew's in Jerusalem. And in the course of researching this book, when they died, they were portrayed on the front page of the New York Times as engaged to be married. And as I'm researching this, I could never find any evidence that they were. And this is what happens when you're writing nonfiction. You, you, If this was a novel, of course they'd be getting married. but when you're writing nonfiction, you can't make it up. So I'm trying to figure out, were they engaged to be married? Were they not? I went to the families, and the family said no. There was no formal engagement. So then I'm trying to figure out, because a lot of their friends were saying, yeah, but they were heading that way. And I had letters that Matthew had written about how he was madly in love with Sarah, and I had some of Sarah's diary entries. And then finally it was Michael who wrote something on Facebook and talked about how a number of weeks before they were killed, Matthew and Sarah came to visit Michael and his new wife, Tracy, and they wanted to find out, Matthew and Sarah, what it was like to be married. And that was what crystallized in my mind about how they were walking that journey. And I was fascinated by that because these were two young people setting out to explore life, and they wanted to explore marriage.
So this isn't in your book, but I looked up the front page obituary of the New York Times, and here was the lead. I'm sure you're familiar with
sure.
this, Mike. They were in love with their faith and with each other, and they died together as the victims of hate. It's hard to hear that sentence without getting emotional.
It is. In the course of trying to research this book, I'm an old-fashioned reporter. When I cover a crime, I like to go to the crime scene, talk to the detectives that handled it. And in this case, in Israel, I went back to Jaffa Road. I walked Jaffa Road. I went to the crime scene several times. I went back there with some of the detectives that handled it. I went there with the ambulance drivers that tried to rescue the wounded and pick up the bodies. I went back there also with some of the counterintelligence agents that handled this as well to try to understand exactly what had happened. But I needed to pinpoint exactly where Matthew and Sarah were sitting in the bus, and I was able to talk to some eyewitnesses who survived the bombing, but also I wanted to get a sense of who was sitting by the window in the bus. They were sitting together, who was sitting on the aisle, and to do that I had to go to the morgue and look at how the blast affected them. And this kind of work is difficult. It's deeply it is emotional. You're talking about the deaths of two young people, but I wanted to portray their lives as vividly as possible, I felt I needed to really talk about how they died and the kind of violence that was committed that day.
So it's February 25th, 1996.
Right.
Matt and Sarah are headed to Jordan.
Right.
They get up early, as you said already, to get on. The number 18 is going to be the first of the bus ride. How many of you have been on the number 18 bus? I mean, it's one of the most iconic bus routes in the world.
Sure. It also takes you through the heart of Jerusalem,
right.
From basically one side of the city to the other.
And we should say that while your book, of course, to tell a real story, focuses on the two of them, there were many victims of that bus bombing.
Yes. I mean, there was a man who survived the Holocaust, and yet he died on that bus. There was a young couple who had left an infant at home. They were going out to look for a new apartment. They died. And on and on and on. There were a couple of Palestinians on the bus who died. It was really a cross-section of people going about, as I said earlier, their ordinary lives.
And who did fate bring them in contact with that morning? And how did he find himself on the number 18 bus?
Well, there was a 19-year-old Palestinian man who was recruited to be a suicide bomber. Now, when I first started covering terrorism, I always thought suicide bombings were the work of maybe one or maybe two deranged individuals. That's not the case at all. These are highly sophisticated operations. And the way I was able to discover this was in the course of my travels back and forth to the Middle East for my newspaper, having no intention of writing a book, I decided to revisit this particular bombing. And I got a hold of a State Department report about the bombing, and it showed that there were about 10 Palestinian operatives who were involved in this, and one of them had been arrested. He was the ringleader. His name was Hassan Salameh. He was the ringleader. He had been trained to make bombs in the Islamic Republic of Iran. In fact, the Iranians financed this bombing. And how were we able to prove this? It was right there in the Iranian national budget. But Hassan Salameh, who was a Hamas operative, pretty high-ranking Hamas operative, recruited this 19-year-old Palestinian boy from a community not far from Hebron. And this young man gets on the bus with a very, very powerful bomb and stands up, and after the doors close, and calls out Allahu Akbar, pushes a button, and this powerful bomb goes off. It was packed with screws and bolts and nails and ball bearings and that sort of thing. Just shredded the bus.
You interviewed him.
Not the suicide bomber. Salameh.
No, Hassan, the ringleader.
Salameh,
the man behind, yeah. Salameh, right?
A deeply disturbing interview. Hassan Salameh is serving 46 life terms in an Israeli prison. When I was in Israel on assignment in 2006, again, having no intention of writing a book, didn't even see this as a book, I wanted to revisit, it had been 10 years since the bombing, and I wanted to revisit this particular bombing. And so I'd heard that the Israelis had arrested and put Salameh in jail, so I called them up. And I'm condensing, you know, just don't call the Israelis up, and I'm condensing some of this. This took place over months. Anyway, they said, come to the prison, you can interview Salameh. And I described this in the prologue, and it was a deeply disturbing interview because I've interviewed my share of criminals. And over time, criminals often change. And as a writer, that's what I look for. How do people change? Do they change? What kind of characteristics does that take on? And what I found in Salameh 10 years later was a man who had not changed one iota. He was stuck in that same kind of warped theology, warped politics, that in his mind justified the killing of innocent people. And I came back, I wrote the story, this is the man who killed Sarah Duker of Teaneck, New Jersey. And then I moved on, and it was some time after that, I had traveled, made a number of other assignments, including to Iraq, and it was after that that the editor of my first book called me up. We had lunch one day, and he said, what are you working on? And I said, I want to write something about terrorism, but I don't know where to go. And then I told him about Salameh, and that's when he said, you need to follow that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Mike Kelly. He's the author of The Bus on Jaffa Road. It's the story of a suicide bombing on a bus in Jerusalem that took the lives of two Americans and many others in 1996. Our conversation was recorded in front of a live audience at the Atlanta Jewish Book Festival. More with Kelly when we come back. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. My guest is journalist Mike Kelly, author of The Bus on Jaffa Road, which details the aftermath of a 1996 suicide bombing that killed two young Americans, among many others, on a bus in Jerusalem. The most chilling interview Kelly did for the book took place in an Israeli prison, where he talked to Hassan Salameh, the man who built the bomb. Kelly and I recorded our conversation in front of a live audience at the Atlanta Jewish Book Festival.
You tell a really interesting story. It's very different to go interview a prisoner. He's serving, like, how many?
46 life terms.
40, all right. But in this country, for a journalist to try to get into an inmate who is toxic, the red tape can be rigorous. You go to the prison, but he doesn't know that you're there and why you're there.
Well,
right?
If you interview an inmate here in the United States at a local jail or in the federal prison, typically what happens is you contact the prison authority, if you're a journalist, you contact the prison authorities. The prison authorities then go to the inmate, and it's the inmate's choice to say yes or
right.
no.
Right, or the lawyer. And
or
you
the lawyer.
But in this case, he knows if
I come into a federal prison or a state prison to interview an inmate here in the United States,
okay.
he knows what's happening.
But okay,
but in this case,
Salameh walks into a room, there you are, he has no idea
sure.
why you're there. And you have a very brief time to get permission from him to continue the conversation.
Right.
So you're thinking, and this is a story that's so compelling, you're thinking, I've only got a minute or two here, what do I say to him?
True. The Israelis told me, they said, you have to introduce yourself, and he can tell you to get lost if he wants.
What'd you ask him?
Well, I said, I'm going to ask him one question, and no matter how he answers that question, I know I'll be able to write a column. So I'm thinking deadline, right? I do work for a newspaper. So I said to him, do you know the name Sarah Duker? And I said it in English. Do you know the name Sarah Duker? And he responded in perfect English, yes. And I said, you do? And that so began an hour and a half conversation with this man who refused to budge off the fact that he knew he had killed innocent people, but nonetheless felt it was justified.
And you asked him, I think, why did you kill her?
Yes.
He had a fascinating answer, I think.
Well, it was complicated. He said, he talked about, he felt that he was a soldier. He felt that he needed to make a statement, but he also felt he was doing God's work. And this led me in the course of my research to really taking a hard look at the theology of suicide martyrdom and suicide bombings. I spent about 2 months studying this theology. I was a lot of fun to live with, believe me. It's really a journey into a very, very dark hole. And, you know, President Obama has talked about if this kind of thing is ever going to change, it's going to have to come out of the Muslim world. And I understand why he says that, because here in the West, we have a concept of martyrdom, whether it's the Judeo-Christian tradition or even Hinduism or Buddhism in the East. But the concept of suicide bombing and suicide martyrdom completely turns that traditional sense of martyrdom on its head. And this is the kind of theology that was embraced by Salome.
That's chilling.
It is chilling. And it really, I think, cuts to the heart of what we're trying to understand here, or at least comprehend. You know, I think for most of us, the whole concept of terrorism is just completely foreign, even though we've lived with it for most of our lives, right? And yet, the idea of standing up in a theater, as these guys did in Paris, apparently, and shooting people at point-blank range, or in the case of this 19-year-old Palestinian boy stepping on a bus, pressing a button, and blowing up the bus, is very difficult to understand, because if they don't know that they are killing innocent people, they're either blind or completely clueless. They do know they're killing innocent people, but yet they've turned it around and justified it in the name of God. I really wanted to get in Salome's face and in my interview with him, and this was not through a glass wall or anything like that. This was literally knee to knee, and I wanted to get into his physical space when I was interviewing him, literally push myself up close and try to shake this guy a little bit. And I got to be honest with you, I didn't lay a glove on this guy. This was a stone-cold killer. But in the course of interviewing him, this is Salome, I was saying to him again and again, don't you realize you've killed innocent people? And finally he said, yes, I know, but she, meaning Sarah, just got in the way. She just got in the way.
My target was not Sarah, my target was the Israeli occupation, right?
Yeah, she just got in the way.
So the book not only gives what journalists call a TikTok, which is really compelling, the story of Sarah and Matt coming to the bus stop, getting on the bus, the story of Hassan Salome assembling there are going to be two terrorist bombings on that day.
On that very day,
there's another one. So it tells us that story in a very dramatic fashion, but it only starts there. You go on and talk about the politics that flowed out of this, both in Israel and, of course, in the United States.
Sure.
So can we talk a little about that as well?
Well, yeah. The other piece to this story is, well, what happens next? And I wanted to tell that story. You know, if you've ever been a crime victim or if you've known anybody who's been a crime victim, I find crime victims ask two questions. Doesn't matter whether you've had your bicycle stolen or something far worse. The first question is, who did this? The second is, how can we catch the person or hold that person, bring that person to justice? It's the same thing with terrorism. Except the difference here is that if you've had a crime committed against you, you know who to call. You call the police. It's not a perfect system, but we know that pathway. With terrorism, there's no pathway. Who do you call? And that's what the families of Sarah and Matthew faced on that morning when they were called by the State Department that your son and daughter have been killed in a bus bombing in Israel. So what do we do next? Who do we call? What do we do? And that's where the story takes up, with the families wanting to find out who did this and hold those parties accountable.
Yeah, I mean, one of the really difficult parts of your book to read is, again, that recreation of Sarah's mother. She's lost her husband.
Sure.
He's already passed away some years before. Getting the call from the State Department. And then Matt's parents also getting the same call and being given this news.
Sure. Right? Try to picture this scene in your own life. Matthew's parents, Vicki and Len Eisenfeld. Len Eisenfeld is a physician who deals with critically ill babies. So he's used to dealing with late night phone calls. Phone rings at 5 o'clock in the morning. He picks it up, and it's a woman from the State Department, Catherine Riley, who I tracked down, by the way. She still remembers having to make these calls. Catherine Riley's on the phone and telling them that, you know, are you the parents of Matthew Eisenfeld? Yes, yes. I have some very bad news. And then he said to me something I thought very poignant. He had to pass the phone to his wife, Vicki. He said, he'd made a vow to himself, Len did. He said, if something ever happened to our children, I never want to be the one who tells my wife.
Yeah.
And so that's how that first call took place. Catherine Riley calls Arlene Duker a few hours later in Teaneck. Arlene is just getting up. It's a Sunday morning. She's making the bed. She's slept late. She was out the night before at a party at her synagogue. And she gets the same call. And she, you know, I think there's a part of us that when, at Bad News, we sometimes go into kind of a numbness, you know. And then she hangs up the phone and it hits her. Sarah's been killed. And she just starts screaming. And that was their first reactions. I felt I needed to really capture that as best I could, because so often what we forget, again, we reduce these acts of terrorism to just a number story, a story of bodies, and we don't realize that there are families at home, in homes all over the place, who take these phone calls and then have to figure out, okay, now what do I do? My son or daughter or husband or wife or someone's been killed. Now what?
After a break, more of my conversation with journalist Mike Kelly, author of The Bus on Jaffa Road. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. Today's show was recorded in front of a live audience at the Atlanta Jewish Book Festival, where I talked with journalist Mike Kelly. His book is the story of the aftermath of a 1996 suicide bombing on a Jerusalem bus. Two Americans, Sarah Duker and Matthew Eisenfeld, were killed along with almost two dozen others. When we left off, Kelly had just described the awful moment when Duker and Eisenfeld's parents got phone calls notifying them of the deaths.
It's from the moment of those phone calls on that this, I call it a political process, it was a quest for some form of justice.
Sure, sure.
That became entangled deeply in politics, and your book goes into that in great detail, and we don't have the time to go over every little piece of it today, but it essentially what happened here is that both families felt they had to find some way to get justice for the deaths of their children.
Sure, sure.
There was no way they were going to, they had hoped, there was at one point hope that maybe there could be a trial of Hassan Salameh in the United States, right?
That's right. That's right.
Okay, that didn't go anywhere, right?
It did not. I described this how, well, first of all, foreign policy is supposed to be handled by the executive branch of the government. If you've ever read the Constitution, it's quite clear. In the mid-1990s, Congress was getting very upset because there had been a lot of acts of terrorism. Big ones, Pan Am 103, for example, had taken place. And the White House and the executive branch were really taking kind of a hands-off approach. Congress passes a law in 1995 that says that if you're an American citizen and your family's been a victim of terrorism and you can prove that it's one of a number of state sponsors of terrorism, and at the time it was Iran and Cuba and Iraq and Syria, Libya, if you can prove that those countries were involved, you can file a lawsuit, essentially a negligent death lawsuit, in a U.S. court. federal court. And that's what the families ended up doing. But here's the, another piece of this story. What about the criminal trial? What about Hassan Salameh? The Israelis arrested him. Now, normally, when a crime is committed, particularly a violent crime against people here in America, the police stay in very close contact with the victims, often telling them, we've caught the perpetrator, there's going to be a trial, etc. And we've all followed these kinds of things. The Israelis never called up the families and said, oh, by the way, we caught the ringleader. They didn't even know who Hassan Salameh was until he happened to pop up in a 60 Minutes broadcast, of all things. Can you imagine learning that this is the guy who killed your son and daughter by watching it on TV? The FBI, however, knew about Salameh. So did the Justice Department. There was an enormous amount of pressure at the time to perhaps bring back, there'd been a number of American citizens killed by Palestinian terrorists. There was a lot of pressure at the time to try to have a criminal trial back here in the United States. So the Justice Department sends two prosecutors and the FBI sends two agents to Israel to take a look at all of these cases in which Americans had died. And they felt that Salameh's case was probably the strongest, to bring him back, put him on trial, maybe a death penalty case. Yeah. And they decided against it. They felt, the strength of the case, I interviewed one of the prosecutors and one of the FBI agents who handled this, and they felt that Salameh's case was the strongest because there was no doubt that he did it. He was admitting it. And not only had he admitted it to the FBI and the Israeli intelligence service, he admitted it to me, he admitted it to Bob Simon of 60 Minutes, he admitted it to all kinds of people. And they were going to bring Salameh back and put him on trial. And then that ran into a real cloud bank. And that cloud bank is essentially the diplomacy between the United States and the Palestinians and the Israelis, and the fact that a criminal trial would have mucked that up, so to speak. So that trial never happened. The families ended up filing a lawsuit and winning a massive judgment.
So do you mind if I walk through it very, kind of briefly with you? There is a determination that Iran is the state sponsor of this terrorist.
Correct.
Right? Although you should tell a story. Mike has a fabulous little story about Yasser Arafat in all of this.
Sure.
Yasser Arafat, the night before this bombing, is visited by a neighbor.
He is. Not just a neighbor, a fairly consequential figure in Middle East politics. His name is Terje Rode Larsen. Now, I'm sure most of you have never heard this name. Terje Rode Larsen is the Norwegian diplomat who was one of the key architects of the Oslo Peace Accords. By 1996, he is now the United Nations representative to the Palestinian people. He's stationed in Gaza. He's in the Gaza Strip, and as he often does, he's meeting with Yasser Arafat, who's also in the Gaza Strip. Arafat is kind of a night owl.
And he can walk right down the street because they literally live a few doors from each other.
They did. And it's Saturday night, the night before the bombing on Jaffa Road. And Larsen goes down to visit Arafat. They're talking about, I interviewed Larsen twice on this because sometimes when people tell you such dramatic stories, you almost don't believe them. So I went back to him months later to just confirm that. He confirmed it right down the line. By the way, the guy who tipped me off to this story was Dennis Ross. Ross is telling me the story. He says, you got to talk to Terje Rode Larsen. And I'm thinking, who is that? And so he tells me. And Ross knew about this story, too. The point I'll make on that is in a second. So anyway, Larsen goes to visit Arafat. And then they're talking about shipments of food and medicine. You know, just ordinary things that a UN representative might be talking to the head of the Palestinian Authority. And at the end of the conversation, Arafat turns to Larsen and says, what are you doing tomorrow, Sunday, the 25th? And Larsen says, I'm going up to Jerusalem. And Arafat stops and says, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't go there.
Are you convinced that that meant he knew what had happened?
I'm convinced in this way. I think Arafat was like an organized crime leader, kind of like Carlo Gambino giving a wink and a nod to a hit. Didn't know the specifics of it, but I think he knew that something was going to happen, that Hamas was going to stage an operation the next day. And this was the dilemma, I think, that, and this was the context that Dennis Ross told me this story. And I've talked to some Israeli officials about this, too. They had a sense that Arafat had a feeling that these incidents were taking place, and was giving a wink and a nod to them and a tacit approval. And yet they never confronted him with it because they felt that Arafat was the key to the peace process.
Yeah. All right. So, again, we don't want to go into this in great detail. I took you a little off track there because I think that story is so interesting.
Well, it's all interrelated.
So the families file this massive lawsuit. They want to get, what, $40 million? I forget the figure. Tens of millions of dollars from the Iranian government.
Hundreds of millions of dollars. Hundreds of millions, almost $350 million they were awarded.
So, and Clinton's in the White House.
Correct.
And there are kind of these conflicting signals from the Clinton administration about this that put the families in a position where they don't really know what's going on, right?
Well, as I said earlier, there was a feeling in our country that these acts of terrorism were taking place and there was really no response. So Congress passes this law saying that Americans can file lawsuits. Clinton, who is running for office, and re-election, I should say, and wanting to be tough on terrorism, has a big bill signing ceremony at the White House. And he has people who lost relatives in Lebanon there. He has families from Pan Am 103. He has the Klinghoffer family there. He has others, and also the Dukers and the Eisenfelds. He has a lot of victims of terrorism. Signs this bill. So a number of these families file lawsuits. Terry Anderson, for example, filed a lawsuit. The Marines who were killed in Beirut in 1983, they filed a lawsuit, won massive judgment. So then, as many of you know, if you file a lawsuit, the next step is if you win, you go back to court and you say, Judge, we won, we want to collect. So try to imagine this scene. The Duker and the Eisenfeld families show up in court, and the Iranians had never tried to defend this lawsuit. They simply ignored it, and the judge said, if you're not going to come to court, too bad, I'm going to rule anyway. But when they come back to collect, some lawyers show up at the next table, but they're not from the Islamic Republic of Iran. They're from the United States Justice Department. The United States Justice Department decided to oppose these American families in collecting on these lawsuits, claiming that to do so would harm U.S. diplomacy overseas. And so try to imagine the scene. You had Congress passes a law, President signs it into law, they go to U.S. court, they file a lawsuit, they play by all the rules, they win, then they come back, and then their own government is trying to oppose them.
And this is where Atlanta native and diplomat Stu Eisenstadt comes into the picture.
He did have a key role. Stuart Eisenstadt, I believe, is one of the most complicated and compelling characters in this book, because it's Stuart Eisenstadt's job as a member of the Clinton administration. He gets handed the task, work out this political mess that Bill Clinton has found himself into. On one hand, seeming to favor the efforts by U.S. families to file lawsuits against terrorist nations. Yet on the other hand, the Clinton administration opposing the actual collection of judgments in these lawsuits. Stuart Eisenstadt, if you don't know, lost relatives in the Holocaust. He had led this country's efforts to get reparations for Holocaust victims and did such a great job, the New York Times wrote an editorial about it. This was a guy who understood his Jewish heritage, but he also was working as a lawyer. And I interviewed Stuart about this. He felt the push and pull of this issue very personally, but also in a very dramatic way, in the sense that he understood, I think, this argument, and I think it's intellectually it's a legitimate argument. Of course, when this bill was signed and allowed these families to file lawsuits, they didn't really think it through. They just went ahead with it for political reasons. But when it really came down to collecting these judgments, it really involved individual families filing lawsuits against foreign nations. And what Eisenstadt and others were arguing is that this is going to set off a huge domino effect for diplomatic relations around the world and could result in retaliation. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I think the argument is interesting enough that you really have to embrace it, and that's what I tried to do and explain it. And it was Eisenstadt's job to sort of carry that water for the Clinton administration.
I think we're ready for questions.
We could go on.
We could. Oh, it's a it's a fascinating story and really well told. So let's start with questions, and then we'll do this brief reading at the very end.
Okay, I'd be happy to. Sure.
I enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
Again, going back to Paris, you have made yourself somewhat of an expert on terrorism over the last 20
years. I don't know if I'm
years.
An expert, but I've certainly written enough
about
it.
You have an opinion, and I'd be curious what you thought the West should or should not do in reaction to what's just happened in Paris in terms of what it can or cannot accomplish.
If I was king of the jungle? Well, the first thing I think they have to do is to not excuse it politically. I think one of the things that I tried to do with this book was to, obviously terrorism has a political dimension, but what I wanted to do was take that and put it on a shelf somewhere, and particularly Palestinian terrorism, obviously that has a political dimension. And I'm guessing that there are people in this room that might even feel some sympathy for elements of the Palestinian cause. Certainly I can understand that, and certainly I do. But what I wanted to do with this book was to take that political dimension, which is too often used as an excuse of just doing nothing, and put that over here and really drill down on what terrorism is. And in my opinion, it's murder. It's just flat-out murder. And I think what has to be done here is that this has to be handled as a murder case and investigated as thoroughly as possible. And then, if it is determined that it is the work of ISIS, then I think they really have to start talking about dealing with this as an act of war. And that was the problem that the Clinton administration, and indeed, and I know I come down hard on the Clinton administration, but the Reagan administration was doing no better. I mean, when almost 250 U.S. servicemen were killed in Beirut in 1983, our country did nothing. When Pan Am 103 went down, and we even found out that Libyan operatives were involved, two of them, and not suspecting there were probably more, our country did nothing there. To carry it forward now, and you know, I know I come down on hard on the Clinton administration, but you know, this George W. Bush administration certainly tried to deal with the war on terrorism, and we know there were many, many pitfalls there. But my point is this, is that I think they have to make it some sort of definitive policy statement as to how they're going to deal with this and to deal with it effectively. Oh,
we got one more over here?
I think I heard you mention during the interview that you had interviewed the father of the bomber.
Sure.
And I think it was Golda Meir who said, we're never going to come to an end to this until the Palestinians love their children more than they hate us. I'd be curious to know more about your interview with the father.
That's a great question.
Yeah, thank you. That was another disturbing interview. I wanted to track down the family of this bomber. So I got in a car one day and drove out to the community, which is not far from Hebron. And I figured if I could get there, I could probably spend enough time on the ground and find this family, and I did. And I spent a fair amount of time with the father. And we talked at length, and I said, listen, did you not know or suspect that your son might be heading in this kind of direction? He said, absolutely not. We had no idea that his son was going to be this kind of murderer, so to speak. His son was not particularly religious. He was not hanging out with Hamas, for example. He didn't appear to have any friends who were Hamas operatives, and on and on and on. This, in general, by the way, is a very, very difficult subject of research because most suicide bombers die. There are a number of Israeli academics that are looking into this subject, and some of them have done fairly good work on it, but yet we still don't fully comprehend. Like, how is it possible that in the case of this young man, he was approached on a Friday and he's committing this kind of operation on a Sunday? And so his father tells me, he says, my son was not terribly religious. He was not hanging out with Hamas, for example. And his father said to me, he said, if I could have stopped him, I would have. He said, I feel ashamed that this happened, and I feel terrible that it happened, and it's forever haunted me. Where the interview, I think, took on its saddest moment was when I asked him, I said, well, how do people remember your son? all these years later. And he said words to the effect, they don't. Yeah. Nobody talks about my son anymore. They don't remember him. Now, I know there's a lot of talk about these bombers become martyrs and that sort of thing. And I think that does happen, and people honor them, et cetera, in the Palestinian communities. How long that goes on for, it's debatable. But the father said to me, he said, this has just faded into oblivion. And what I've done is, you contrast that with the lives of Matthew and Sarah, and another figure in this book, Elisa Flatow, who was also killed in another bombing related to this. Their lives have hardly gone into oblivion. If anything, they are celebrated again and again and again by their friends, and written about on Facebook and that sort of thing, even to this day. So it's
we're getting a wrap, and I know everybody wants to get books signed. We're not going to get to read that excerpt, but I thought, in closing,
sure,
because it also speaks to the victims in Paris this weekend, you have a very moving scene almost at the end of the book in which the families go to visit the gravesite.
Sure.
Matt and Sarah are buried side by side.
Sarah was about to turn 40, or would have turned 40. Matthew and Sarah are buried side by side in graves in a cemetery in Connecticut. And around the time of what would have been Sarah's 40th birthday, we drive, Lenny and Vicky and Arlene, Matthew's parents, Arlene's mom, and one of Sarah's sisters, and me. We're in a car, and we go to visit the graves. And I begin with Lenny in the car. Len turned at a light and steered the car on a narrow road that led through a grove of oaks and maples. Everyone fell silent. It was after 6 p.m. The August sun, already starting to sink into the western Connecticut hills, left wide pools of shadows under the leafy trees. Len parked, and we got out and walked up a gentle slope to a headstone that simply said, Duker Eisenfeld. Arlene laid a rock atop the headstone, a traditional Jewish custom. Len and Vicky followed suit. Someone mentioned that Sarah would have turned 40 in a few days. Everyone nodded. A breeze kicked up and brushed the leaves of a nearby maple. Arlene, Len, and Vicky stood for a moment in front of the headstone and the side-by-side resting places of the daughter and son they once thought would marry. I wonder what they would have become, said Arlene. Her voice fell off, and then she added, we'll never know.
Mike Kelly, the bus on the road to Jaffa. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Thank you.
Mike Kelly is the author of The Bus on Jaffa Road. Our conversation was recorded in front of a live audience at the Atlanta Jewish Book Festival just after the terrorist attacks on Paris. C-SPAN videotaped that conversation for broadcast on Book TV. I'm grateful to them for allowing us to play the interview here on Two Way Street. We posted a number of links related to today's show on the Two Way Street Facebook page. You'll find a video of the very moving memorial service that was held for Sarah Duker and Matthew Eisenfeld in Sarah's hometown of Teaneck, New Jersey, just after their bodies were returned to the United States. Sarah and Matt were buried side by side in the Eisenfeld's family plot in Avon, Connecticut. If you're interested in learning more about Mike Kelly's work, we've posted a link to his columns in the Bergen Record. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Please remember, you can listen to Two Way Street on your own timetable by downloading the GPB Atlanta mobile app. You'll also find On Second Thought with Celeste Headlee and all of your favorite NPR shows on the app. And one program note, we're living through the most extraordinary presidential race of my lifetime. And because it's attracted such great interest, we've decided it's time to expand GPB Radio's political roundtable show, Political Rewind. You can continue to listen to our live shows Fridays at 3, but starting next week, we're adding a second live show Wednesday afternoons at 2. So I hope you'll join me and our panel of smart, savvy political insiders for Political Rewind every Wednesday at 2 and Friday at 3.
That's it for us. Our producer is Jonathan Reedy. I'm Bill Nygut. I hope to see you back here again next week for another Two-Way Street.